And this is what I used for myself. I remember I had a list. My very first list was rake up the leaves on the lawn and buy the milk. And to rake up those leaves, I mean, I rake up leaves really fast these days, but to rake up, it was like, I don't know, it's probably the most difficult thing I've ever done. But I was determined I was going to do it. If I've set tasks like that for other people, I was going to do it for myself. But it took so much energy out of me. And to go down to the milk bar just to buy a carton of milk, that was the end. And the next day, I added another thing to the list. And I kept, until one day I didn't need the lists anymore, because I was getting up to 25, 30 items. But that's the way maybe a psychologist would tackle it. And that's why I was so angry with Iris Murdoch and her silly approach, I thought, to depression. Depression from a psychological point of view is a curse. Of course it is. And we help people to get through it as quickly as possible with external programs, like this what I've shown you here, or with medication.
That was from a talk given to the C.G. Jung Society of Melbourne by Peter McCree. And welcome to the Society's podcast. I'm Ariel Moy. The Jung Society offers a space for the exploration and development of Jungian ideas and practice. We offer talks on the third Friday evening of every month, as well as courses and workshops, a Jungian library, a newsletter and discussion groups. Please visit our website at jungsocietymelbourne.com or our Facebook page. Peter McCree taught in many different areas of psychology in the science faculty at Monash University for much of his career, as well as practice as a psychologist. Now retired, he's enjoying himself as a member of the Simulated Patient Network, which helps train medical and paramedical students in communication and clinical skills. In this talk, Peter describes how he began engaging with Jungian psychology after grappling with a line in Iris Murdoch's The Good Apprentice that spoke about depression as a journey, and even at times a willing choice. In the midst of his own depression, this idea infuriated him, but ultimately sent him on an intriguing journey of his own. Beginning and ending with personal stories of his experience with depression, Peter guides us through differing conceptualizations. With an exploration of depression as understood and managed within modern psychology, Peter then contrasts this with a surprisingly different approach to depression in Jungian psychology and practice. The symptomatology, ways we might work with depression, and its potential gifts are explored. Considering Jung's model of the psyche, the writings of Freud and Thomas More, and the mythology of the great god Saturn, Peter offers us a way of thinking and feeling about the appearance of depression in our lives as purposeful. A few of Peter's responses to questions are included at the end of this talk. We hope you enjoy.
First time I experienced a deep depression. It was after a loss, a very, very sad loss. I'd certainly had little bouts of depression before, things that go for about 1 or 2 days. But this was a deep depression. And I knew it was a depression because in psychology we have a book called the DSM-4, and it's sort of like a recipe book or a shopping list, and it tells you what symptoms to look for if you have some sort of dysfunctional behaviour. So I knew I was in a depression. Here are some of the things you have to have to meet the criteria. I don't know if you can read those. This is called a depressive disorder, and as you can see there's a list of things there. I've just selected some of them, but you have to have at least 5 of those before you qualify, and you have to have the first 2. So I certainly had a depressed mood. You have to have this over a 2-week period as well, or it doesn't count. So I had certainly had this, I think, for about 3 weeks. I certainly had depressed mood every day. You have to have over that period, and certainly lacked pleasure in things that I usually enjoyed. All of a sudden, I love music, and all of a sudden, music just wasn't important to me anymore. You have to have changes in your sleep, and your weight. Some people put on weight, I lost weight. And some people sleep a lot, other people don't sleep at all. I couldn't sleep. Restlessness or fatigue, even with everyday things, very, very simple things. I can remember, rake up the leaves in my garden. The rake felt too heavy, and I love gardening, so that was out. Couldn't make decisions, that's another thing. And I'm a man who prides myself in making decisions. And I mean on very, very simple things like, shall I go and get the milk or not? Yeah, things like that. Feelings of guilt and worthlessness. No, I didn't have too much of that, but there was another one there I did have. Disorientation with time. During that two-week period, and thank goodness it was in January because classes weren't affected by this, but during that period, I could tell you if it was day or night, but I didn't know what time it was. I didn't care what time it was. I just knew that it was day or night. And recurrent thoughts on suicide. Certainly, I can remember just staring, sitting on the back. This sounds awfully sad. I'll lighten it up as we get along. But I can remember sitting on my back veranda, looking at the plum tree. And the image I have was of myself hanging with piano wire from the plum tree, which is not a... Quite a few years later, I was telling that story about that image hanging from the plum tree to one of my friends. And she said to me, you know, Peter, when I went through the same thing as you went through, I had the same thought, but it was from an apple tree. And then we had a bit of a laugh because we thought, how would we have got the wire out of the piano? We're not technical people, so how would we got the wire out of the... and why did we choose that? But it was certainly an image of how where we felt we were. So that's what is called a depressive disorder. I certainly had it. There are other types of depression. I don't want to talk about them very much, but there's reactive depression. Reactive depression is when you know what caused the depression, or you think you know what caused the depression. You can have what's called endogenous depression. This is a depression you're not always too sure where it's coming from. Okay? It's more an internal thing and you can't predict it. A reactive one, you certainly know where it's coming from. You can have melancholic. Melancholic usually is more to do with the body symptoms without all the other things. Dysthymic depression, it's more like a chronic depression that can go over, say, up to 2 years. And you can have seasonal affective disorder. That's another form of depression. A lot of people, notice the abbreviation, SAD. A lot of people some people in the Northern Hemisphere suffer from that because of lack of bright light. And the therapy that they give these people is an exposure to bright light. It's got something to do with a substance called melatonin, which sets off our sleep-awake cycles. But anyway, I'm sort of talking about a depressive disorder there. And I just wanted to draw your attention. This book classifies depression with many, many, many different ways. One of the things I was doing during this time, I think, I read a lot, certainly did read a lot, anything that was very, very different in a way. Paris in the 1930s I seem to be reading a lot about. That's sort of like, I don't know, just avoidance and stuff. But I did start to read a book, and it was a book by Iris Murdoch, and it was called The Good Apprentice. And the story, I never finished the book. I still never have finished it. But the book, the story is about a man called Edward. And Edward went to visit one of his friends, and he took him some drugs. And he gave his friend the drugs, and then Edward went to see his girlfriend. While he was around seeing his girlfriend, his friend took the drugs and jumped out of a window. Edward became very, very depressed about this, and he sought help. And I've just taken out a few extracts because this is where I stopped reading the book. This is when he went for help, this is what he said to the... Well, I thought it was a psychologist. This is what he said. I'm changing, but not in a good way. It's the chrysalis story run backwards. I used to have coloured wings and fly. Now I'm black, and I lie on the ground and quiver. Soon the earth will cover me, and I shall become cold, and be buried and rot. Well, misery likes misery for company, and I thought, I've got a soulmate here because this is how I'm feeling. So I was very, very interested to hear what I thought the psychologist would say. And I got a shock. Because the first thing she said was, yes, yes, that's a good image. And she said, now listen to me. You are undergoing by an accident and by your own fault a spiritual journey which many would consciously purchase at a great price but cannot buy. And this greatly disturbed me. I was very, very angry when I saw that. I thought, here you've got a silly novelist who doesn't understand anything about depression, anything about psychology. How dare she write like this? I felt that my own experience was devalued. How dare she say that I was going on a spiritual journey which many would consciously purchase at a great price? I was insulted and I was angry. Momentarily, what happened, at least I had another feeling. I started to register anger, but I was very, very angry. And the anger stayed with me for a year and a half. Oh, I was really anti-Iris Murdoch. she also continued, I've just taken little bits out because I'm going to come back to this. She said, experience this strange energy fully. Gee, my training in psychology is we try to block this experience for people and get them through it quickly. And she said, which is also, although is so ambiguous, is God-given, given to you by the dark gods. I had no idea what this meant, and still very, very angry. Your old self is dying, but another self is watching it die. So as I said, this disturbed me a lot, and I couldn't stop talking about it. Didn't finish, sort of in protest. if you know anything about Jungian psychology, this was activating something, because I was telling everybody, if they'd come to my place, I'd read this. Yeah. Because while I was going through my period of depression, I turned to psychology. I thought, I can remember after about 2 weeks when I finally decided to buy some milk, I came back and I have a brass plaque on the front of my house that has all my qualifications and says what I do. And the sun hit the brass and sort of hit me in the eye. And I looked at it and I thought, well, Peter, you've helped a lot of other people. Isn't there anything in psychology that could help you through this? And so I thought, well, what has psychology taught me about depression? Let's see. The first thing I could remember was, and it didn't help a lot, was what Freud had to say about depression. What I remembered was he distinguished between depression and grief. And I wasn't too sure what I was feeling. Was it grief or was it depression? Freud developed a theory on depression. It comes from a thing he wrote called Mourning and Melancholia. And he distinguished between depression and grief. He said that even though these two things share a lot in common, what he noted about depression was that a lot of his patients also were very, very angry people. They had internalized anger. There was a lot of self-blame. So even though you could have somebody who was mourning, they didn't seem to have the same self-blame or self-hate. With the depressed people he saw, there was a lot of self-blame and self-hate. In fact, if the depressed person would have said the things that they were saying about themselves to another person, do you get that? Then you would have said that person, that depressed person, is showing anger to the other person. If they said the same things that they were saying about themselves to another person. So he thought that one of the attributes of depression was self-blame and internalized anger. He thought that this was particularly true of a dependent personality. And this disorder, the depression, could be imagined or it could be a symbolic loss of the person. What it is that you're feeling the loss of another person, but you are angry that they've gone away. Now, you're meant to love the other person. What you do is, you, instead of feeling angry about them going away, you displace that anger onto yourself. And that can be quite symbolic sometimes, or imagine it could be, if I lose my job, my wife won't like me or will leave me, that sort of thing. So it was really true of dependent people. So that didn't help me a lot. It really didn't help me a lot. But that's what I sort of remembered about Freud. One of the other things that did help a little bit was the antidepressants. I thought I was going to get something from that. I knew that they weren't successful in all cases, antidepressants. I'm not going into a big biological thing about them, but one of the things about antidepressants is, I've been worrying how I'm going to explain this in 2 minutes, but neurons send messages to each other, and they send messages via chemicals. You can see down here. This neuron is sending a message to this neuron down here, but it also sucks back some of the chemicals. It's sort of like a sending and sucking process. Sometimes too much is sucked back, though, and so the message is not sent on. So what an antidepressant does, as you can see here, blocks some of those holes to prevent too much of it being sucked back. Yeah, that's a very simplistic way of looking at it. But I certainly knew that antidepressants might help. I know that they reduce depression 50 to 65% in people. So yeah, I went on antidepressants. I also knew, though, that that studies have been used where one group, say this group is, say you're all depressed, and we've got one group here, and I give you a form of antidepressant, and I give you sugar tablets. And I say they're antidepressant and they're going to help you. They're called placebos. I know that 50 to 65% of you lot will probably, the depression might lift, but 25 to 30% of this lot will also report that their depression has lifted. So it's. I also knew too that the drugs act immediately in this process, but they usually take 2 to 3 weeks to have any effect on the person. So I didn't worry about all of that stuff. I thought, if anything can help me, I'm going to take it. So yeah, I took antidepressants for a short period of time, and something happened. Something happened. I didn't get magic, but something happened. As a psychologist, I'd worked with depressed people. Actually, our training is my training has been a bit anti-drug. So it was with great, I'm surprised I'm even saying I took them, but we're meant to be embarrassed what we did. But when I'd work with depressed people, we'd use this sort of tack, and I guess I used it for myself. One of the things, if you've ever been depressed or if you've ever been around a depressed person, they're not a lot of fun to be around, are they? No. And they can't help that, but they're certainly not a lot of fun. And if you've been around a depressed person, I guess indirectly or even directly you send the messages they're not a lot of fun to be around. And one approach in psychology is that depressed people lack a lot of positive reinforcement. So one of the things when I've worked with depressed people is, you know, you saw one of the symptoms on the checklist that a depressed person loses interest in things that usually have given them pleasure. Yep. Well, one of the things you do is you reintroduce pleasurable events into the person's life. I've done that with people. I can remember one woman who was, she loved gardening, and I was working in a clinic, and I was going to use this approach with her, and I said, I want you to go to the botanical gardens and count 10 different flowers. The next time, I want you to tell me about those 10 different flowers. That took so much energy for her to do that. So much she was crying. This was somebody who was an avid gardener, who loved, and she was distraught. And I said, next time, if you want to stay working, we're going to have to do 15. And it was something that she'd loved was now a torture. We got up to 30, and something just happened. She discovered, it was a little violet growing under a rock, and for some reason that touched her, and there was a little glimmer came back, and I kept forcing her to go back until she was able to go back herself. So that is a lot more difficult than it seems to reintroduce pleasurable events. Another tack using a behavioural approach, what you're doing is you're changing their behaviours, hoping that they will get a lot more positive reinforcement. A lot of depressed people, really, particularly if they suffer from fatigue, they don't take the trouble to look after themselves or look after their house. One woman, I said, I want you to go and get your hair done. No, I'm not going to do that. I don't know how to do it. I'll get confused. I won't know what. I said, I want you to go and get your hair done. She did get her hair done. I said, tell me what happened. She said, quite a few people said how good I looked. And this is the idea of getting a little bit more positive reinforcement, trying to break the cycle. It took her an enormous amount of energy. She didn't want to get her hair done. But that's the whole idea. You enhance, maybe get the house painted, but a few changes, so there's a little bit more positive reinforcement coming through. And the other thing that I've done with people is often depressed people don't do very much. So at the end of the day, you know, what's their conversation going to be about themselves or how they're feeling, because they haven't done very much. And so sometimes I've set people a timetable of daily activities, nothing that is too difficult but always challenging, so that at the end of the day they're able to say, well, I've been able to accomplish this. And this is what I used for myself. I remember I had a list. My very first list was rake up the leaves on the lawn and buy the milk. And to rake up those leaves, I mean, I rake up leaves really fast these days, but to rake up, it was like, I don't know, it's probably the most difficult thing I've ever done. But I was determined I was going to do it. If I've set tasks like that for other people, I was going to do it for myself. But it took so much energy out of me. And to go down to the milk bar just to buy a carton of milk, that was the end. And the next day, I added another thing to the list. And I kept until one day I didn't need the lists anymore, because I was getting up to 25, 30 items. But that's the way maybe a psychologist would tackle it. And that's why I was so angry with Iris Murdoch and her silly approach, I thought, to depression. Depression from a psychological point of view is a curse. Of course it is. And we help people to get through it as quickly as possible with external programs, like this, what I've shown you here, or with medication. But this kept nagging me, this spiritual journey that people would... where's this coming from? So I found myself in Chicago, and there's a lovely Jung Institute in Chicago. It's probably... I think it's just out of Chicago, but it's a very, very, very warm institute, very, very friendly and warm institute. And I thought, I'm going to do a Jungian short course, because I've got to know about this. This is nagging me for too long. I have to know about this. And there was, I guess I got the right person. But don't they say that you always find the analyst that you need? Well, this is one running a short course, and I think I got the right one. Okay. What I wanted answers to were, you know, what does this Murdoch mean by the old self is dying and a new self is watching? What is this journey that many people would consciously purchase at a great price? I didn't go in that asking these questions, but in the first session, her name was Lucy Klein, the first session, she went through a model, which I hadn't seen before, of Jung's structure of the psyche. I sort of knew what it looked like. I had seen other models, but this one really made a lot of sense to me. So I'll show you what she taught us. She started off, she's lovely. She's like a mixture of a crone and a grandmother. You know, you sort of felt, oh, she's like a warm old grandmother type, but then there was a gruffness there, and I liked her very much. We all did. So she put this diagram up, and it comes from her, Lucy Klein. And she was going through Jung's structure of the psyche, and she said, well, in the collective unconscious, we have all the archetypes together, all enmeshed. The way I think of archetypes anyway, because I'm a psychologist, I know Jung didn't use this definition, but I think of them as sort of psychological themes. I think he referred to them as innate emotional predispositions or something like that, but they're easier for me to think of psychological themes. And in the collective unconscious, you have this mass of confusion where they're all there. The mass of confusion contains all the archetypal potential, but in the dark there is no consciousness. So they have to be, for each of us at an individual level, they have to be experienced consciously. And so that's where the ego shoots out. So she had the Massa Confusa, and then the ego for the individual sort of shoots out of that lot. It's a little bit more to it than that. Because certain archetypes become activated, and they sort of colour the ego for each of us. And I've got three there. For that particular ego, that particular individual, those three archetypes are very important to that individual. That's a very simple model. It was a little bit more complicated when she gave it, but you probably get the message there. How are archetypes activated? Well, she told us they're activated by disposition. If you're an introvert, there'll be certain archetypes that you'll be more attracted to, perhaps, than if you're an extrovert. She also told us that socialization is very important, depending on what society you live in, or what family you come from, or what cultural background. There are certain archetypes that are a lot more difficult if they're prohibited by society to display. And I think one of them was the crone. You know, when if a woman displayed crone wisdom, well, she didn't particularly one of the things about the crone the archetype that's associated with the crone is that there's a lot of intuition there, but there's a lack of men. They don't require men for power. And if you live in a patriarchal society, that's very threatening, so you get killed. So depending on what sort of environment you're living in, certain archetypal themes are more difficult to express and may be prohibited. Not to say that they're not acted out, but they're acted out under great difficulty. And she also said, and this is where I'm coming from now, is stress and what is required for further growth. Now, this grabbed my attention. What's this stuff about further growth? She said that what happens periodically, I'll go back to my little diagram. We'll just use this bit here. Periodically, material from the collective unconscious attracts the attention of the ego and gives the ego material it needs for further growth. So ego energy starts to become attracted to unconscious contents, and the energy that flows from the ego to the collective unconscious is experienced as depression. That really grabbed my attention. I thought, this is making Murdoch a lot more credible. Of course, for this to, I mean, that can happen and people may not do anything with it, but creative work certainly is required. I mean, you need to know what is attracting ego's attention. What is coming from the unconscious that is so important that ego must have? I think this particularly happens, even though it does happen periodically, it particularly happens when ego becomes a little lopsided or develops an extreme attitude, you know, a narrow attitude, because there's a lot of other things that the ego could be doing as well. So this can happen then, and it's like the collective unconscious is saying, "Hey, you need some more material," and sometimes has to attract ego's attention, and energy is zapped from the ego, and that. Zapping is experienced as depression. But as I've got there, creative work is involved, because in order to understand what is required, you have to do creative work. I mean, work with your dreams, work with images and symbols, that sort of thing. And according to her, this sounds like a cookbook, something that happens very quickly, of course this takes time, but the depression goes once you integrate that material. Of course, if you do integrate the new material, the ego that you had at the beginning is going to be slightly different. Uh-huh. Now, that sort of made sense to me in terms of what Murdoch was saying. Murdoch was saying, old self is dying, old ego is dying, and another self is watching. Because Jung talks about the self archetype that is responsible for integration and harmony. That made a lot more sense to me. In fact, something that I've got from that is that it's a very positive thing, and if you believe it, I think it's a very, very optimistic way of looking at life. From this sort of model, what I get is that there's part of me that knows more about me than I consciously know, and it also knows what I need. Okay, there's part of me, there's another self, an unconscious self, that knows more about my requirements in life. And it will give it to me when I require it. But that's going to be difficult, because if I think I've got to change and integrate that material, and that can be very, very difficult. A lot of us like just to stay where we are, particularly if life's pretty comfortable. Uh-huh. It's very important that the death of the old ego is psychological, not a physical death. I think that's where suicide comes into it. Those thoughts of suicide, I think, are psychological. They can be sort of psychological images, but sometimes people act out the suicide. And what's going on there is that they're it's not a psychological death now, it's a physical death. They're projecting the death of the old ego onto the physical world, to the external world. And this is what this is not about. It could be the death of the old ego, but not the death of the person. So from a Jungian point of view, he called this transformational depression. From my understanding and reading of Jung, he certainly didn't go into classifying depression the way the DSM-4 does. But one of the things that you do get from Jung is this idea of a transformational depression. Periodically, you take on new material and integrate new material when it's required. So a transformational depression, it's normal. We're all going to have it. It's a creative process. It's purposeful. It's telling us what we need to do next. It's a transition. It compensates. It compensates perhaps that sort of depression, that process compensates for what we may not be doing at the moment, particularly if we have a very lopsided ego. And it appears in cycles. You just don't have one bang of it. This goes on in cycles. So this is the journey that Murdoch was talking about. Then I understood. I start to pay a lot more attention, I think, to what Murdoch was saying. And particularly, I don't come from a background of literature or mythology. I know Jungians do. I used to wonder why they studied mythology when I was a much younger psychologist. I'm going to be unkind now, Kevin, but I used to think you studied mythology because it sounded like psychology and you didn't know the difference. That's true. But since my trip to the Chicago Institute, I've been to quite a few other institutes, and I really can appreciate why Jungians are interested in literature and mythology and the arts, because you find great references, very powerful references to this image of the journey. In a lot of the literature, it's going out into the wilderness. You know, that depletion of ego energy is going out into the wilderness. It is not an easy process. It's a difficult process. That's one way you can hear of it. Another one is, where I've heard of it, is the Night Sea Journey. There's a book by Carolyn Pearson, too. You've probably heard of it, Awakening the Heroes Within. Some of you heard of that book, yeah? And she talks about this as well. She talks about the journey, that sort of ego energy integration process, as an initiation. And she says any initiation that you have really is a shift of perspective. And that's what's happening there in that model that I've pointed out. It's a shift in perspective. Another word she uses is disorientation. Imagine if in psychology we had labelled depression initiation, or we had labelled it just disorientation. Certainly different way of looking at depression, but we don't in psychology, but she does. And I love what she said here. Many of us don't choose our initiation. It appears just to happen, and it is quite a shock when it does happen. This is all getting at what Lucy Klein was talking about to us. Warren Steinberg is a Jungian with a clinical background. He wrote a book called Circle of Care, Clinical Issues in Jungian Therapy. And he was very interested. He worked with people who were chronic depressives. And in his practice, he noticed that most of the people that experienced chronic depression, severe depression, were in fact extroverts. This is just what Warren Steinberg, his book is Circle of Care. And what he's saying is that for an extrovert, extroverts who are very interested in the external world, that normal compensatory function is blocked. That being if ego has to be attracted to contents of the unconscious, that's when you have to introvert. Now, an extrovert, particularly an extreme extrovert, is going to have difficulties with that. And he says that what happens here is that with pathological depression, the extrovert is forced to involuntary introvert. It's nearly like it's given a big kick. And he saw that as very typical of the extroverts that he was treating in his clinic, of the depressives, that they were extroverts, and they needed to be forced to introvert rather than it being a natural process. I've got a few thoughts about that, because what he's saying there, it's probably more difficult for an extrovert to introvert and to integrate the material or to become aware of the material. I wonder sometimes he doesn't say this about introverts, but I wonder about introverts sometimes. I wonder sometimes if they don't get stuck down there. What comes to mind is a young student that I taught, a very bright young student. He's about 24, 25. And he came to see me. He's very introverted. He came to see me because he hadn't had any he didn't know where he was going in life, didn't have a goal, he didn't know what sort of job. And he'd never been in a relationship. He's a very good-looking young man, too. And he had read every Jungian, Freudian, esoteric, any self-aware, he'd read them all. Every time I would mention a book, he would write it down. And not only like most of my students write the books down, but he would go and buy it. So he did a lot of reading, but he was very, very introverted. And we had a talk about it, and I really felt that he needed to experience a little bit more of the external world. He seemed to be gone. He kept going down, but nothing was coming up. He wasn't changing in any way. And I said, look, I'm not highly intuitive, but I said, what I'd like you to do, I think what might be a good idea, why don't you go to a gym? You know, you go to a gym, you're going to be, well, what's the back of my mind? He's going to really experience the external world. Let's get him experience, not reading books about, but experience the external world. Be with other guys his own age, get hot and sweaty and feel the real world, feel pain. And he came back the next week and he said, well, I sort of did what you said. I read a book about gyms. It's just, Steinberg doesn't talk about that, but I just wonder sometimes if introverts don't have their own difficulties with integrating the material. Maybe an extrovert sort of can go down there sometimes and then quickly get up again, but maybe sometimes introverts get too stuck. I'm not sure. That wasn't the only thing, though, that sort of concerned me about Murdoch. The other thing that I didn't understand at the time was that thing about the dark gods. Mm-hmm. Remember, she said that this condition had been given by the gods. It was a good image. and the guy was meant to experience the feelings. I didn't quite understand what she meant. Remember, I didn't know very much about mythology. So I thought, okay, if we talk about gods, is there a god that is associated with depression? And there is. And that god is Saturn. This is not Satan, Saturn, the black sun. This is a picture that is a very famous picture that was painted or drawn, I think, by Goya. And here he is. I wish this was a dark room because this is a very... You know this picture? Many of you know this picture? There's Saturn there, and Saturn is devouring one of his children. And I think it's a very, very, apt depiction of... Yeah, that's better. I just wish this wasn't a church. Okay, that's okay for a church too, because we've got to sometimes see the dark side of human nature too. Okay, thank you. In the early Renaissance times, to be depressed, they had another expression for being depressed. People were said to be in Saturn or a child of Saturn, particularly if it was a chronic depression. I want you to think about that too. If we replaced the diagnostic classification of depression and we said, oh, you're in Saturn or you're a child of Saturn, you know, that's a much more imaginative way of looking at depression than having a checklist. You know, oh, you're depressed because you meet 5 of the 9 categories, and here they are. This is a much more imaginative way of looking at depression, isn't it? I gave a lecture 2 years ago to a group of psychiatrists, and I was very, very concerned about it. It was their one lecture on Jung. And I consulted a lot of analysts before I did it. I was very, very nervous about giving it to psychiatrists. And they said, don't talk about any of the things like depression or anxiety or neurosis. Talk about Jung the man, but don't talk about, because they've got different explanations for this. They've got medical models. I don't know how, but we got onto depression. I could feel the words coming out. Oh, in the Renaissance, they used to say... And there was a lot of sniggering and laughing, but the professor got up and interrupted. I'm not used to being interrupted, but he interrupted and he said to the group, there were about 30 of them, he said, you know, in the latest journal of the, whatever it's called, the Australian Psychiatrist, it says that we must be sophisticated. And sophisticated means being able to understand and take on a wide range of perspectives. Now, Peter is describing a very different perspective how other people see depression. Take note. There's a lot of tension in the room then. But, okay, well, this guy Saturn, what about him? I'm going to tell you, as I said, I don't come from a mythological background, and I'm not going to tell the story, well, in a few minutes as nicely as it could be told, but just to refresh your mind, or if you don't know what it's about, there were 2 very important gods. There was Uranus, and he was married to, is it Gaia, the Earth Mother? Gaia, yeah. And they had 12 big kids, and they were called the Titans. And Uranus was very, very frightened that they were very, very powerful. He feared their strength, so he threw them to the earth, got them out of the way. But, how do you say it? Gaia? Gaia, yeah. Gaia gave one of them, who happened to be Saturn, a sickle to help defeat Uranus. And he did, he castrated him. Uranus, of course, wasn't very happy about this. And he cursed Satan and he said, well, when you grow up, the same thing will happen to you. So Saturn married Rhea, And because he worried about this curse, he devoured, he ate his children. I'm sure it's told better, but that's basically what was going on. Zeus or Jupiter was born, and Rhea, his mother, substituted a stone for the child. So Saturn swallowed the stone, and all the other, and regurgitated all the other other Titans. So Jupiter defeated Saturn, and Saturn was expelled and went to live in Italy, where he ruled the Golden Age, but he was ruling men or humans, and he turned out to be a very wise ruler, lived to an old age and a very wise ruler. So there's some, if I had time I could have told it a little bit better than that, but there's some wonderful images from this myth that link in beautifully with depression, and I've picked out a few of them. Well, we've got him devouring his own children. That's a really horrible, but I think that's very symbolic of depression feeding off itself. Depression does, it prevents future and new possibilities. I think that's a really lovely symbol there. He ruled during a golden age. What we also have there is often people who are depressed have a melancholic longing for the good old days, but never again will it be as it used to be. And also Saturn is associated with time, the end of the harvest, and the sickle or scythe. And of course one of the things we associate with depression is that there's a sense of time running out. Life is over and death is approaching. But the gods and the goddesses, like the archetypes, because gods and goddesses are personifications of the archetypes. They're not the archetypes. They're one way of depicting the archetypes. They also have positive and negative qualities. And there are some positive qualities, if you like, to do with Saturn. I tried to find a picture of him not devouring his children, but being the good ruler. I had great difficulties. I found this. This is meant to depict that, being the wise, kindly king. But when I looked very carefully, he's still got one of the kids in his mouth. But you get the idea. Here we've got the wise king who ruled for a long time. I think what we get from that, another aspect of depression, and this is something that, if you've read it, it's a lovely book, it's a beautiful title. It's called Care of the Soul by Thomas More. It's been around a while now. He's written some things since this, but there's a chapter in it, a very short chapter, called The Gift of Depression. That's where I sort of got the title from this talk from. And he talks about Saturn and some of the qualities associated with him. He says that, yeah, he was an old man who ruled wisely, that particularly in medical references, he was seen as the god of wisdom and philosophical reflection. And Thomas More talks about this a little bit. This idea of being an old man, he says that with age, many of us have a sense of lived through something, of living through something, and being older and wiser as a result. With age comes the knowledge that life does consist of suffering. Very few people grow to be old without learning that. That life is full of suffering. That's the reality of it. And at the end of life, there's death. Thomas More also says that psyche tied to eternal youth is doomed. We live in a society that tends to perpetuate that myth, I think. He talks about the metal that is associated with lead, Saturn, and that's lead, that very, very dense metal. And what he says there is that when we're young, we have thoughts. They're rambling thoughts, they're disconnected, they're light, they change. But as we grow old, these thoughts coagulate and become dense, like lead is a very dense metal. And through these, the thoughts start to coagulate, this is where our values and our philosophies come from. So what you get from also from the God of Saturn is wisdom, but a very sobering, realistic view of life. Life is not always fun and games. It's serious. There's suffering. At the end of life, there's death. And that's a reality. In fact, in some of the Renaissance gardens, some gardens in had a special place set aside where you would go to, if you like, evoke a depressive mood. Now that sounds very, very strange for the sort of society we live in. I mean, most of us are running furiously away. We don't want to ever become depressed. But there's a time and a place where this mood can be very, very helpful. I love this little quote. Melancholy thoughts carve out an interior space where wisdom can reside. Now, that is a fairly romantic look at depression. I think there's a lot of wisdom there, but a fairly romantic look at depression. So I thought anyway. I was going to end with one of the stories that Moore talks about. He talks about a priest, and if you want to read about that, I'd rather talk about something that's more meaningful to me, I think. Last year, I was very, very fortunate. I was granted sabbatical, and I was given 6 months off on full pay. Yeah. I'd worked for it, but yeah, I got it. And I was also going to go back to the Jung Institute in Zurich, and I was going to spend 6 months there auditing a course. And I was going to be granted the money to go there. We're talking big bucks there too. I thought I was very, very lucky. I was very, very fortunate. I was going to write a book. And I thought, well, this is my time in life. You know, when it's all granted and handed to me. Unfortunately, the 2 days before I was going to go to Zurich, it's a long story, but I was let down by a friend who I was going to be staying with there. It was very, very unfortunate. It had something to do with perhaps miscommunication, but it also had something to do with money. I can remember I had a little mark on my face, and I remember waking up thinking I was going to go to get it just checked, and I woke up and the first thought on my mind was, I hope it's skin cancer because then I won't have to go to Zurich. And I heard myself think this thought, and I thought, what's going on here? You don't want to go to Zurich, do you? And so I decided not to. I didn't quite make the checklist of a depressive disorder, but I had quite a lot of the things. So I went to my boss and I said, look, the Zurich thing has fallen through. What do you think I should do? And he said, well, why don't you make up another itinerary at the last minute? So I did, and there's a bit in San Francisco, a little bit in New York, and people thought I was on Easy Street. They thought, isn't it wonderful? There was, look what he can do. And I went back to my boss. I said, it's not going to work out. It's two bits and pieces. It's not what I want to do. And he said, look, I think I'll come back to work. Let's just forget about going to Zurich and writing a book. He said, look, write the book at home. We won't say anything. Just write the book at home. I said, no, I don't want to do that. I want to come back to work. He said, well, Peter, you can't come back to work because we've got sessional staff to take your place. And everybody thought I was so fortunate. I stayed at home for 3 days and I could feel the energy going. Now, this is a guy who's given sort of a lecture on depression before, And I kept on saying, so where's the gift in this? The anger was coming back again, like, where's the gift? Where's the gold in this? I couldn't see anything. I was, and I could feel things slipping away. And I thought, I know it's ego energy going somewhere else, but I don't care. There's nothing good about this. And then I stopped and thought. I thought, Peter, why are you feeling like this? Is it because you can't go to Switzerland? I thought, no. Actually, I don't like travel. I do quite a bit of travel, but I get homesick. And I knew that 6 months was going to be a big test for me. So no, and you've been to Switzerland before. Is it because you've been let down by a friend? No, you've been let down by friends before, and you've managed to survive. And you only saw this particular person once a year anyway. So that's not. Well, why are you feeling like this? If it's not Switzerland, it's not the friend. Where is it coming from? And where it was coming from was I wanted to go back to work, and I wasn't able to. And then it struck me, and I thought, you know, if I was retrenched, if I was to lose my job, what would I do? What I learnt then, the thing that I was identifying with work too much. And I was shocked, very, very shocked. I didn't think I was a person like that. I've helped people who identify with work. But I didn't think I identified with work. But when it was, I was prevented from going back to work, and I realised that was a lesson. I related this story I didn't know that at the time, but I sort of related the story to a Jungian analyst a couple of months later on. I said, I can't understand what happened with all this Lyric stuff, because the very day I went to post my application to the Zurich Institute, I had to go to the post office, and there was a car in front of me, and it had a Swiss sort of sign on it. And I thought, you know, all roads are leading to Zurich. This has to be. There's the Swiss number plate or the sign, and I'm just about to post my application form in. You know, synchronistic, whatever. And as Jungian analysts only do, she looked at me and she said, don't know if you're meant to go to Switzerland, but you are meant to post in the application. And from that, what I have learned, I love my job, but I had to make some changes. And going back to sport, taking new activities as well, but not letting the job, not all my identity being invested in a job. And I think I did get something out of it. So the one thing I think is difficult with depression, maybe from a Jungian point of view, and that's with people who are having trouble with insight, and it's very, very difficult to have insight when you're depressed. I think, though, I've asked a number of Jungian analysts, American Jungian analysts, when would they have trouble working with a depressed person? And each of them said to me, if they can't be creative, if there's no dreams coming through or nothing to do with images or they can't paint, they said we would have a lot of difficulty with that. As long as there's even a little bit of creativity, we've got something to work through with. So anyway, I think that's where I'll finish tonight. If you do have any questions or any comments, I'd certainly welcome them. That's a lovely expression. A cup carved out by sorrow can hold a greater joy. So what you're asking is, how do you reconcile being a different person, having been if it's successful? I think throughout life, there's a lot of periods where change takes place. It doesn't have to take place through being depressed. And I think that's what Carolyn Pearson is, when she talks about initiations, she's not just meaning things like depression or anxiety. In some ways I don't see, the process may be different, what happens to you, but I think throughout life we do change. I don't think I'm answering your question though. You're saying that how do we reconcile that we're not the same person? Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of being radically different. I don't think you sort of swap personalities. I think it's not like the complete death of ego. I think it's maybe that's a little bit misleading. I would think that there's integration. There's still me and a bit. I see it quite. I don't see it as radically different, because you'd really have to. I see it as integrating the new stuff. So you're still there, but there's a new aspect, a new perspective, new way of looking at the world in part. Hope that helps. I sort of asked the same question to Lucy Klein, and she looked at me and she said, you know, if you don't listen to your dreams, psyche will try and capture your attention in another way, through your emotions, through the complexes. And if you don't listen to your complexes or your feelings and emotions, psyche will get you in the body. So I'd say yes, yeah, ego would try again. It's a cyclical procedure. Some people I've spoken to, particularly if... Well, Jung actually, when Jung went through, in Memories, Dreams and Reflections, he went through it wasn't just a depressive sort of state, it was nearly like psychotic, when he went down and he explored his fantasies. But he writes about that and he says that it was very important that he reminded himself who he was before he did that. That he was a psychiatrist and he lived in a certain street and he had responsibilities. What he was getting at there, it's very important to have a pretty grounded ego to be doing that work. And, I wonder sometimes, maybe the focus should be on getting just like a psychologist deals with the ego. And if the ego is not strong enough to take on the new stuff, then I wonder what can be done. I don't know, maybe an analyst could. As a psychologist, I would probably say I'd be looking at the ego to see maybe we need to patch up the ego a little bit as well. Like that stuff I was talking about, the behavioural stuff, in conjunction with maybe working with the unconscious. But that's from a psychologist's point of view. I have heard. See, some Jungian analysts are also trained. The people in San Francisco are doctors, and most of them are doctors first and clinical psychologists. So they're used to medication. Some analysts I've heard say that no, they don't like to prescribe, they don't like to work with people with medication because the creative stuff can't get through or is tampered with. And some analysts I've heard from the San Francisco Institute have said, well, we can only work with somebody if the ego is in some particular state. So I think that's a really difficult question. I mean, I guess it's a very subjective one. I mean, no, I really haven't got a clear answer to that. Yeah. Awakening the heroes within. 12 archetypes to help us find ourselves and transform the world. One reservation I have about the book is that I don't like the idea of 12 archetypes. There's a few more than 12. But I like it. I think what I do like about this book, I've used it with my students to give them a feel for Jungian psychology. But I always like them to go beyond the book because there are more than 12 archetypes. Yeah, I'll repeat the question. The question was, when you were going through your own, was it in retrospect that... In retrospect, did I recognise the gift of depression? The first time around, no, because I was very angry with what Murdoch had to say. Something did happen, though. I was doing something in the garden. This was some time afterwards. And it was something that the person that I had lost would have done. I was planting bulbs. Now, I'm too impatient to plant bulbs. I want seedlings. I mean, you know, you buy the ones with the flowers on the top still. And it struck me that, and I was planting these bulbs, it's just that the person that I'd lost would have done, and I felt quite at peace. And in some way I felt, it was a very, very crude way, but I felt I had integrated something about that particular person. It really struck me. Here I am planting bulbs that she would have done. And maybe the qualities that I so loved and admired, I had now started to, I don't know, integrate. And I didn't know the words integrate then, but there was that little second in the garden where I felt something had happened. But no, I didn't know about gifts then. That's why I really pushed myself last year to say, well, I won't use the expression I used, but where is the gift in this? Here is something, I'm slipping into a depression. I talk about depression. Where is the gift in this? That was a very conscious effort. There was a dream that I did pay a lot of attention to. There was a sort of quite a numinous dream that caught my attention. I sort of didn't tell the whole story. And it was that dream that started me to think about, well, was it Switzerland? Was it the friend? Was it work? Because the dream was about work. And so that's before I wouldn't have paid much attention to dreams.
Hello. Yeah, I'd just like to, on behalf of the group, thank you, Peter. And I think for me it was it's a real gift to be able to combine academic clarity with the personal quality, and certainly that was something I felt come through this evening. So on behalf of everyone here, thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed Peter's moving talk on depression, incorporating his own experiences as both practitioner and client with two quite different perspectives. A modern psychological approach that focuses on getting through depression as somewhat of a curse, and a Jungian imaginative approach that takes note of the generative qualities of depression. As we engage with the urgent call of the unconscious to address imbalances in our ego, our extroverted, outward-focused energy does diminish for a time. But this diminishment or depression can be in service of meeting and integrating necessary qualities into our lived experiencing and our ego. Ultimately, Jung's transformational depression can bring with it many gifts. With authenticity, experiential and academic knowledge, Peter conveys the hard-earned and positive qualities to be found in depression, or rather, in our relationship with the image of the realistic and wise god Saturn after his banishment to Rome. Thank you for listening, and please visit us at www.jungsocietymelbourne.com or have a look at our Facebook page.